The news is Kirsten and Lincoln are not quite having a baby yet. But it's imminent. And Kent and Sharon are going to be grandparents some more soon, very soon. And speaking of rebirth, it's not Baptism Sunday. It's not the one that we planned. But here's how it works. We have this plan that on the first Sunday night of every month, we fill up the baptistry. And then we let God do whatever he wants. And tonight, no, he will. God will never muscle his way in. He waits, and if we give him space, he'll do stuff. But if we're not standing there going, I wonder what God's going to do next, then he won't intrude. He just stands at the door and knocks. I love that one painting that has Jesus standing at the door knocking. And if you look closely at that beautiful painting, the artist made a mistake and didn't put a doorknob on the door. Oh, it can only be opened from the inside. Ah, now you're going to go home and Google that one. So tonight, the Holy Spirit is messing with us in that Peter Yackel is going to be baptized into Christ, even though it's not the right Sunday. And we are going to celebrate with him and with, and we just need, oh, wait. And speaking of birth, Don and Teresa are more grandchildish. Last Sunday night. And Don is still with the baby. Wait. Mary had a baby on last Sunday night. Named? Does anybody else love it that the babies are now getting our grandparents' names? Praise God for birth. Praise God for life. And he is the source of and he is the giver of. And we celebrate it. But tonight we're going to especially party with Peter. But we mentioned this beforehand, even though he's back in class. I lied. He's in the back of the room. Because God may have tapped you on the shoulder and say, this is your night too. So be thinking about giving your heart and soul fully to him. This may be your night also. The Magi. If you look in the right. Version of the Bible, they don't call them wise men, they call them magi. It's just one of those words that we toss around only at Christmas time. They were astrologers. They were from the east of Israel, from Babylon or from Persia, and they noticed. They were stargazers, and they noticed things changed, and so they paid attention to the signs. They were aware of what was different. And they walked away from their lives. And they walked away from all that was important. And they left their home because this was absolutely miraculous. They did enough research to discover the Jews. They have predicted that something miraculous is going to happen. And so they followed the star. It intrigues me that even though the Jewish story wasn't theirs, they were aware. Those outsiders that were physically far away from the center of it all in this tiny little country of Israel were aware that there were predictions in ancient texts, ancient Hebrew texts of a Messiah. It amazes me too that they weren't nobodies. That is, well, okay, we sort of have made up three names, but we don't actually know what their names were. We actually don't even know if there were three of them. We just go three because they had three presents, and everybody had to have something, right? They were influential because the king at the time was Herod the Great. And though Israel was small, this was a man of power and influence. And these guys come in from out of town, and they immediately have an audience with the king of the nation. They were somebody. They were people that had some influence, so that they met and told the king why they were there. As a matter of fact, while I'm wrinkling my face up over that, oh yeah, that's weird. They got to speak to the king. They also had the nerve to go before the king, Herod the Great, and say, we're here to see the king. And he's going, no, the other king, the one that was prophesied. They asked the king for directions. Now, I'm a guy, so I don't know a lot about asking for directions. But they go to the king of a nation to say, so how do we get to that place? What do your scholars say? And he didn't have the answer. So he has a meeting with his scholars, like Luke read to us a few moments ago. And they said, oh, well, it's going to be in Bethlehem. And they spell it out for him. And then he calls them back in for a secret meeting. And he says, lying through his teeth, okay, you go and search Bethlehem. And when you find him to worship him, I bet he tried really hard to not roll his eyes, to worship him. You come back and tell me so that I can worship him as well. And so they do. They follow the king's directions and they find the village and they find the baby. And Herod the Great is incredibly juxtaposed to our king. Herod the Great on one side, and on our side, our king is exemplified by vulnerability and weakness and helplessness. He was born into a poor family, and his ministry was about the poor, and he didn't live a great life like that other king. But he lived a life of self-sacrifice, constantly demonstrated day after day after day, until the one day when he sacrificed his life. And you can't separate the birth from the death. Brent and I sat at the Pepperdine Bible Lectures the spring after our son Ryan died. And we were just singing with thousands of people all at once. And there came a moment as we sang the words, from life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. And I still can't sing that song without tearing up, because it's the first time and it's the only time that I've experienced somebody's first cry and final breath. You can't separate the birth from the death. And here's this vulnerable, innocent, absolutely helpless baby. And that's our king. And that's the chief conspirator of this crazy Advent conspiracy that we've pledged ourselves to. These wise men were not playing around. It wasn't just them being curious scientists. They were serious. They were serious because they came bearing gifts. And we sing pretty glibly about gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But I'm imagining Mary and Joseph's eyes widening as they pulled out these treasures, all of them costly, all of them deeply symbolic, and that's another sermon, all of them profound. I wonder, did they accept them graciously and with deep gratitude? Or were they tempted to even draw back, like, this is too much? But it absolutely was not, because they did their homework. They knew. The difference was these wise men were men of priority. They understood the stakes. They had an inkling that this was historic and profoundly significant. And so they sacrificed in big ways. Tonight, as we talk about giving more and spending less, I sort of want us to start there, and that is that true generosity flows from a heart that's driven by priority. These co-conspirators, as we listen to the truth in their story, it's really important that we don't just gather some information, but that we hear with our heart. It's got to be more than just an intellectual understanding. It's got to be something that's connected to our deeper motives. Because as we passed that collection basket a while ago, we could have fished money out of our pocket, tossed it in there, not given it a thought. I have to confess, which is exactly what I did tonight. I fished out a check and I tossed it in, and it failed to be a moment of worship. Praise wasn't in my heart. I looked past the basket to see what it was that I needed to be ready for in the next moment. And praise was lost in logistics. True generosity comes from a heart that's driven by priority. So co-conspirator number three, maybe it's three, four, and five. We're going to lump them all together and talk about the Magi. Give more and spend less. We're lumping these two together because I want to be one of those guys that's driven. I want to be a guy that says, yes, I want to be generous. I want to be somebody who is more giving in every way. That's a godly goal. That's a good thing. I want to be a guy who gives more. Yes, I think it's a great idea to not go into debt at Christmas time, to not buy into the consumerism that is so demanding, to not buy into the craziness, to not go with the cultural flow. I think it's prudent and wise to spend less, because guys, this is a season of excess. It really is so easy to cave, to be indifferent, because it's piled in our mailboxes, how to spend money. It's in every television commercial. It's on the radio in between songs. It's on billboards and store windows, and everything says this is the time. This is Black Friday. And what that means is it's black because this is when businesses finally are in the black, because so much money is spent on the Friday after Thanksgiving. Ta-da. Everybody's going, oh, that's why it's Black Friday. I thought it's black like it's doomsday. Oh, no. This is businesses that are now in the black. They get to that day after Thanksgiving, and woohoo, we're going to make it one more year, maybe. Mm-hmm. An hour after. Or the day. Let's not go there. I think it's honorable and noble to free up some resources to give thought to. I want to be supportive of these noble and honorable goals. As you look at the some of the families are doing the what's the calendar that we passed out? What's that called? Advent calendar. Couldn't remember. Advent conspiracy. No. You've got this Advent calendar at home that's beautiful and lovely on one side, but if you turn it over, there are some noble opportunities to give toward, to help out people that are stuck in sex trafficking, people that whose lives have been destroyed by wildfires in northern and southern California. There's opportunities and options, and so to spend less frees up more money to be gracious and big and good. Guys, this is a dangerous thing for the senior minister to say. But if the only charitable contribution you have is the Renovatus basket that goes around, I'm deeply grateful because it pays my salary, but you need to think bigger and outside the box. There needs to be some things that you see beyond the horizons, and we're not just doing our own little thing here, though paying my salary is really, really important. God just might be doing something that goes beyond the borders of this room. And so we've got to be aware, and it's right and good for us to free up resources to support other opportunities. It's right and good for us to give more intentionally. And it's right and good for us to give relationally. You seem like you have something, Brenda. Friday on the calendar, the gift to give during the Advent season was smiles. For pity's sakes, give a smile. Okay, this is how I do it. Every afternoon, I'm walking to my bus. I don't have to leave at the same time that everybody else. So there's this massive rush of hundreds of buses that are trying to leave at the same time, but not me. And that makes me happy. And I spread that joy. As the bus drivers are lined up, bus after bus after bus, I'm walking and going. Occasionally, I stop in front of a bus to pick up something off the ground and look at it while they're going, get out of my way. A smile is free, but we get so stingy with some of the most simple things to give from our hearts, to give relationally. This is the season. But spending less requires us to make a plan, to create resources, to have financial margins that we can work out of. It requires advanced planning. Okay, I'm going to pay off this bill so I can free up some cash to be more generous, to make a plan, to do some research. It's tough because it's countercultural. It really is all about the generosity. And that's not complicated for us because, frankly, Jesus was generous, so I am. It's not more difficult to understand than that. Because I'm trying to live like him and behave like him and look like him, I just give stuff away. I have underneath my chair tonight some stuff that Arlene gave me. It's now going to match our Christmas village that's under our Christmas tree that our grandkids decorate every year. Because Arlene gives. The main reason why I have that is not about our Christmas tree, our grandkids. It's really more about the fact that God has put a generous spirit in that woman right there. And I happen to be sitting on the night that I'm talking about generosity, I happen to be sitting on another one of her gifts. But where does that kind of open-handedness come from? I mean, how do you get there? What are the steps to take? Let's pick that apart a little bit. When you live out of priority, when you determine to live by priority, you live out of courage and not fear. In the first two verses of Matthew 2, the wise men weren't afraid of Herod. They could have said, okay, we've done the research. We know it's Bethlehem. Let's not go into the capital city. It's just a couple miles down the road. There's lots of people. We could ask any Jew, really, what the Old Testament says, because they know. And so, but it was the right thing to do to ask the guy at the top. And these were people that had the influence. And they just lived courageously. When you're living out of priority, it's easy to make decisions that are based out of boldness. I'm doing my quiet time at Starbucks this morning, and I just realize when I'm doing my quiet time, I'm a man of courage. And when I leave Starbucks, I forget. I have all the boldness and the braveness when it's just me sitting with God. But I go home and there's a dog to feed. And I go to the bus barn and there's middle school fights to break up. Broke up my first fight this week. It was awesome. There's things that don't make me cower in fear. It's just life that happens and I forget. Okay, this is a little bit goofy. It's just between me and God, but I'm now going to share it with you. So I wrote a C on my hand. And I can't tell you how many times today as I've washed my hands or as I pick something up, I saw that letter. It's drawn so that it's upright to me and I could see it exactly. Oh, that's right. I'm a man of courage. When you live out of priority, courage is more easily mustered. As a matter of fact, when I'm making choices and decisions out of fear, that probably needs to tell me, oh, I'm not doing it by priority. I'm not putting first things first. It's a check for me. Secondly, when you live by priority, you invest in the right things. They made a huge sacrifice. Their gift was huge. First, the travel. To get from Persia by camel. I'm sure they had camels because all the pictures have camels. To get to Jerusalem requires a lot of money, requires a lot of time. They were walking away from their livelihood to make this huge, costly journey. The sacrifice of time, the sacrifice of danger, standing before the king that all kings are driven by jealousy, right? Our petty and small people. The expense of the gold and the frankincense and myrrh, they had to get something that was right and appropriate for a king, and they got kingly gifts to give to the baby. It was the right thing. It was the good thing. We can see their sacrificial hearts in verse 2 and verse 10 of chapter 2 of Matthew. But also, they were generous and they were extravagant in their gift giving. When you live by priority, you know what things are worth investing in. You know what things, you have some basis for deciding this is worthwhile. I'm going to sacrifice big time in this. You invest in the right things. Third, when you live by priority, you live in peace and not anxiety. When you're putting first things first, it comes with the gift of calm. Your shoulders drop a little bit. You can breathe a bit better because when you're doing things that you know to be right and know to be good, even though it's complicated, even though it's difficult and hard to make those decisions, there is a certain level of calm that comes with it. So you stress out less over what other people think. These guys, they're standing before the king and they say, "Excuse me, your majesty, but we're here looking for directions." Directions to where? Directions to the king. They just didn't care. Or they weren't that wise. You see what I did there? When you live in peace, you don't have anxiety over who's in control. I thought of a good example. They're standing before the king and they say, "Your Majesty, we're here looking for the real king." Oh wait, it's the same illustration. I'm just saying, these guys were remarkable in their willingness to realize this is the king of Israel, but he's not the one in control. And that's where we're in pursuit of. It's anxiety over what others think. It's anxiety over wondering who's in control. It's anxiety to know where real security and safety comes from. And the truth is, their security didn't come from King Herod. There was something else that gave him a deeper sense of peace. And finally, when you live out of priority, authenticity becomes the measure. You're able to live with a level of genuineness and honesty. I'd like to quote my daughter, Jennifer Reese. In November, she said something on Facebook, and I thought, that is profoundly true. She said, "When do we stop believing that the pictures we draw are not our best gifts? Because we start off believing that it's the best thing we can offer, and we believe it's the best thing other people could possibly receive from us. And then somewhere along the way, we manage to find shame and all those other reasons for why our best isn't good enough anymore. Somewhere along the line, we stop giving our parents pictures to hang on the fridge. I sort of liked it that the kids tonight went, 'That's mine.' Of course, Bella said, 'That's my sister's.' And so she immediately drew me a picture. Love your kid." This represents my treasures. Kids and grandkids. This is one of my bus students. It's a cat. I really don't understand the giant red dots on the side or why some legs are huge elephant legs and other kids' legs are little tiny sticks. She gave this to me about a month and a half ago, right at the beginning of the school year. She said, "Do you still have a picture of my cat?" I said, "Yes, I do. Would you bring it back so I can see it again?" So that's going to bus 245 tomorrow. Because it was real. I can't tell you how many gifts I've gotten that actually had some other person's name. I didn't give this to my teacher, but I'd like to give it to you. Thanks. And I don't have all those pictures. But I got the cat because there was something to that. It was best efforts. I think my granddaughter that's a college student might be embarrassed by this one. But when she gave it to me in fourth grade, it was a gift. It was a treasure. This one from Sawyer in Oklahoma City, we're going to see her next week. They're treasures. Yes, I realize that hands shouldn't have 18 fingers. Yes, I'm confident that Jones, who is 13 and brilliant, would not necessarily feel great joy or pride about this picture. But when he was 2, there's this verse that I got to share with the Agape Church 2 Sundays ago. By the way, on the 23rd, when Ron and Lori Clark are here, I'm so excited that you have a chance to hear from him, but I got to step in his place, and I shared this really tacky verse from the book of Malachi. From chapter 2, it says, "Listen to me and make up your minds to honor my name, says the Lord of heaven's armies, or I will bring a terrible curse on you. I will curse even the blessings that you receive. Indeed, I've already cursed them because you haven't taken my warnings to heart. I'll punish your descendants. I will punish your descendants." Now the King James Version says it in a tame way. "I will punish your descendants and splatter your faces with the offal from your festival sacrifices. So here's the picture. We're going to honor God and we're going to butcher a bull. And we're going to cut up this carcass and we're going to discard the skin and discard the internal organs and put the meat up on the altar. And this will be a fragrant offering to God. And God was just really specific what they were to do and how they were to do it. This had been going on for hundreds of years, for generations. And God now says in Malachi, that stuff that you've been throwing away, I want you to know what I'm going to do with your sacrifices. This lovely sacrifice that you've given to me as a gift to make me happy, I'm going to reach into your refuge. And I'm going to reach into the bowels, the intestinal tract of that cow that you have on top there. And I'm going to scoop up a big handful of manure and I'm going to be spreading that on the faces of your children. That's how I feel about the sacrifices that you've given me. That's how hurt I am that you keep doing the right things on the surface but not giving me your heart. He goes on. I will splatter your faces with the manure from your festival sacrifices, and I will throw you on the manure pile. Then at last you will know that it was I who sent you this warning so that my covenant with the Levites can continue, said the Lord of heaven's armies. Here's the deal. As Israel was being influenced by other sources, they weren't saying, well, let's go worship that God over there. Hey, they have a nice God over there. Let's go worship that God. That's not how it worked. It's just that they heard the messages of, you'll get a better crop. You'll have more fertile fields. You'll have more fertile wives. There was a whole lot of fertility things going on because if you didn't have a lot of children, you didn't have any kind of retirement plan. Somebody's got to work the field. Somebody's got to pay the bills. And it was enticing. And so as they stood there before the altar of Yahweh, it's not that they rejected the altar. It's just that they began to add other stones on the altar that was once exclusively him alone that they trusted. And just in case, they started hedging their bets and started, well, let's consider the weather god. And while they worshiped Yahweh, they were literally sacrificing their babies.
Imagine an idol that looks like a big human mouth. And they would stoke the fire inside this furnace that was shaped like a face until it was red hot. And they would take their sweet babies and place it on the tongue of that altar. And they heard the cries, and they went from that worship service to Jehovah. And that's why his heart was broken. It wasn't just that his bride was being unfaithful to him. It's that it was destroying beauty and purity and goodness. And so the stones were added right beside Jehovah's. I'm talking to some teenagers once, and I take my Bible and I put it on this stool in front of me, and I pick up a magazine. And I tear the cover off, and there's a pretty face on front. And I said, we worship beauty, right? Yeah. I said, okay, we don't worship, but it's a big deal. You gotta wear the right clothes, but it's a reality in our culture. Yeah. So I put that down, and I pulled out another picture, and it was a car. I said, better the car. the more prestige. Yeah, that's part of our culture. And so we were just talking about culture and the way that we spend money and time and what's important. And I just kept tearing pages. I said, now let me take you to a text, to a scripture. And I couldn't find my Bible. Okay, I pretended like I couldn't find my Bible, but finally somebody said, oh, it's piled underneath all those pictures. And that's when I said, and there is the problem. Guys, the Advent season is a conspiracy in that God broke in to rescue. And it's really easy to let the stuff get piled up on top that we forget the baby Jesus that's under there somewhere, and we lose the meaning and we lose the depth and we forget what's most important for us to truly spend money and time and energy on. And we start pursuing things and spending money on things that didn't cost us anything. It was a sacrifice, and it was important because of David's disobedience. People were dying and people were sick. And God confronted David through a prophet. And so his response was immediately to make a sacrifice. And the place where he was at was actually a threshing floor. And he said, we're going to make sacrifice right here. And the farmer that lived there who owned the threshing floor, he said, I'll provide the cow, I'll provide the wood, I'll take care of it. And David said, you will not. I will not sacrifice anything to God that has cost me nothing. And instead of giving gifts out of our hearts, we started giving God tokens. We started giving away gifts. We start spending money rather than investing our hearts, thinking that he's going to be more impressed with a nice hair dryer than he is with a self-portrait. At Christmas time, be a conspirator. Be a conspirator by giving graciously. Make a fist with your right hand. Make a decision to give with courage, with bravery, with a willingness to stand up and do things that are right and good and honorable. Spend differently. Be creative with your gift giving. Try to be untouched by consumerism. Do something that is countercultural that requires of you courage and bravery. With the same hand, hit your heart. Be conspired by giving from your heart first. Let your Christmas list be made out of your heart and not your head. Think in terms of what would be a blessing to this person or that person. How can I speak the language of their heart? How can they know that this is just a token of what's going on in here? Be brave. Give with your heart. And finally, open up your hand. Give selflessly. Don't hold on tight. Look for ways to be, a wise man. Look for opportunities. Listen to the lyrics of this song.
told you, you had the power to give someone hope beyond their wildest dreams. What if I told you it's right there in your hands, in your hands? It's hard to imagine how something so small can make all the difference, tear down the tallest wall. What if December looked different this year? What if we all just give this Christmas away? If there's love in your heart, don't let it stay there. Give this Christmas away, and your life will be changed by the gift you receive when you give this Christmas away.
God help us to give more, spend less.